Welcome to episode 2 of the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast. Once again, I'm your host, Alex Greyhawk.
And I'm your co-host, Jackson Eflin.
So this week we are going to be discussing Pocahontas and Moana.
Where last week the movies were very different, in this one they're almost comically similar.
Yeah, it's really interesting that these got matched up together. It's also really interesting because they are seated 16 and 17 respectively. So these are the two middle of the pack films on the bracket. So, starting off with synopses, Pocahontas opens with a ship in England heading towards the New World. They're on the seas, they get caught in a storm. The young, naive, wide-eyed youth is thrown overboard. One of the protagonists, John Smith, jumps overboard to save him. After that, we open up on the Native American village. We see the goings-on there. Then we cut to Pocahontas, who is out and about in the wilderness. You're alerted that this is not an uncommon occurrence, and she doesn't spend lots of time in the village. Eventually, the settlers land, begin to look for gold, because they've heard stories of lots of gold from the Spanish in the New World. So they just immediately begin digging. The Native Americans are curious and a little unsure of what to do with these new people in their lands. There's some conflict. Eventually, Pocahontas and John Smith meet, start a romantic relationship. One of the Native Americans is wounded. Both groups of people decide that they need to go to war with the other. John Smith attempts to dissuade the colonists from fighting the Native Americans, and he's captured, sentenced to execution. And at the last minute, Pocahontas jumps on top of him as her father is about to execute John Smith and says, "If you want to kill him, you have to kill me too." Because of this self-sacrificing display, the colonists decide, no, they really don't want to fight. We're not going to do this war. Radcliffe tries to say, no, I want my gold. The colonists are like, no, we don't really listen to you. We'd listen to John Smith and let bygones be bygones. And then a wounded John Smith is put on a boat back to England.
Where Pocahontas takes place in explicitly 1607, Moana, released in 2016, takes place in a non-specific fantasy Polynesian setting. A rebellious young girl wants to sail and explore the world, but her father says, no, you can't, you have to stay here where it's safe and become the chief. She eventually accepts this role, but when a great darkness spreads out from across the sea, she must go forth and explore, spurred on by her village crazy lady grandma telling her the secrets that her people were once sailors, and her grandmother charges her to find Maui, who stole the heart of Tafiti and created this great darkness, and make him return it and restore peace to the islands. With the help of the ocean, Moana finds Maui, finds out that he's not this great provider, but is actually kind of a jerk, and the rest of the movie is her trying to get him to be a better person and confront his history of trauma and restore the heart of Tafiti. This they eventually do when Moana realizes that the lava monster that has been keeping them from the place where the heart was stolen was actually Tafiti, transformed into a terrifying rage beast by the trauma that she's suffered. Moana puts the heart back, the lava monster Taka turns back into Tafiti, and restores all to its proper form. Moana goes home, bringing the knowledge of sailing to her people, who go off to explore the islands that are now safe again.
Do we want to talk about Pocahontas or Moana first?
I think before we talk about either, we should talk about the elephant in the room, that these are both very commercialized stories of indigenous people made by capitalist white America, and we are both white Americans with no real knowledge or connection to either of these cultures. We're going to try to do our best with this, but we're probably going to stumble, and I think we want to try to not get into the politics too much because it's out of our lane. We have posted some stuff on Facebook and Twitter of people who are from these cultures addressing these issues, and if you're interested in that, read them. We're going to do our best.
What did you think about Pocahontas?
I think it had a lot of narrative flaws, but before we get into that, let's look at the art, which isn't always the strongest point. It has some really nice color moments, but a lot of the film is kind of the same level of contrast all the way throughout, and it doesn't hold up that well. Some of the standout moments, though, like Colors of the Wind, have these beautiful pastels and lovely pinks and blues that come out really well. So there's that going on, at least.
Yeah, it's really weird. There are some parts of the movie that have this really great dramatic lighting. You can see the contrast of lights and shadows, like filtering through the trees or coming from like these motes of light. But there's other times where they completely ignore what should be going on with the lighting and just have these very flat characters within this very flat background. And it's really, really jarring, especially compared to other points in the movie where the lighting is gorgeous.
Something, something, flat characters joke. Also, I know this isn't the real issue. I know it doesn't actually matter, but the boat changes sizes like 18 times. Like, there's a point where it's twice as tall as these Virginia pines, and then other times where it's small enough to fit down a river. And I feel like you need to at least get the size of your boat right.
Another thing I do want to praise it for, it's animations for all the water throughout the film are really great looking. There's the storm scene at the very beginning of the movie. There are all the scenes with Pocahontas in her canoe, and the water always looks gorgeous. However, sometimes they toss this fog storm effect over everything, and it completely obstructs all of the beautiful animation going on. It's really frustrating because that effect is messy and heavy-handed, and it blocks off all the good things that the animators did.
They also do a lot with leaves and bits of light floating in the wind and hair moving. And for a movie with wind as a big part of the plot and central focus and all that jazz, animating wind is hard because it's invisible. On the other hand, a lot of the crowd scenes, especially in Pocahontas' village, everybody kind of looks the same. They're all just these similarly colored bodies and similarly colored clothing that don't feel distinct.
I want to get back to the clothing, but first I want to dive into Grandmother Willow, her design, specifically the CG surrounding her. It has not aged well.
No. Although they do get some good expressions out of her because of how they use the tree-ness to create the wrinkles of an old face and all that jazz. So on that front, it works. But that just goes to show that they had this actually good traditional animation that they slapped an unnecessary effect on that doesn't work.
And they use CG in other parts of the film. They use a lot of CG for animating the ship. And it doesn't look bad there. It's not that the CG is just bad and terrible at this point in time. It was not used appropriately with Grandmother Willow and sticks out like a sore thumb, whereas its more subtle uses for the ship do a much better job of blending in with everything else. I do want to go back to the costumes of the indigenous peoples, specifically Pocahontas. There's a lot of skin showing. Pocahontas also does not have any sort of footwear. With a lot of the female native characters, it has this sort of sexploitation vibe to it.
Mm-hmm. We talked a lot about how the way she moves and the way the camera frames her kind of focuses on her, I guess, thighs, as it were. I don't know. I don't notice these things.
There are scenes with her sneaking around, crawling around like on all fours, and her butt is kind of prominent in those scenes, and it's definitely very male gazy. There's a couple scenes where they distinctively give Pocahontas bedroom eyes. There's also a couple scenes where her and John Smith are together and they exaggerate her breathing to accentuate her bust, which is also a little...
This movie is G-rated.
Yes. That is another really surprising thing about this movie. It's a G rating.
We should probably get into some of the reasons it ought not to have been G-rated, but one more thing I'll say. The colonists, you've got kind of those three guys. The Scotsman, the not-Scotsman, and Christian Bale. And they all look very distinct and different. But with the native tribes folk, there's not... We don't really have those three guys or those three girls or anything. We just have people who you can't really tell apart, so you don't have quite enough of a sense of these people as living and lived in as the colonists are.
Yeah. All of the native characters, with the exception of Pocahontas's friend, are all involved in the power structure of the tribe. Whereas with the colonists, you have Ratcliffe, who is the power structure. You kind of have Wiggins as his manservant, is probably the best word. And then you also have the other colonists who are kind of just there for a paycheck. And having those different perspectives from the colonists gives them a lot more depth of character, where you don't get nearly that much of the same from the natives, and it's really disappointing.
And I think characterization is a big problem with a lot of the film. These characters generally aren't great. A lot of scenes wind up being more expositional than character building.
There's also some other weird stuff going on with characterization, especially Ratcliffe, where you have a very foppish character, but a lot of his interactions with Thomas, Christian Bale's character, promote this toxic masculinity, which is odd coming from a foppish, sort of effeminate character. There's a weird juxtaposition there that I'm not sure works.
Agreed. Especially when you also have John Smith, who I would all argue is also kind of promoting the toxic masculinity, but unintentionally. Whereas Ratcliffe is clearly using this idea of greed and manliness and manifest destiny as a motivation tool to get gold out of the ground. John Smith is just sort of this big action hero who is really, really sure that what they're doing is exactly what they should be doing and doesn't seem conflicted about bringing civilization to the natives as like an explicit thing that he intends. And the fact that no one really questions that this image of John Smith, the mighty hero, is a motivational factor for the other people as well is a problem.
There's a lot of problems with John Smith. He mansplains things to Pocahontas, although we do get the best song in the movie, Colors of the Wind, because of it. So I'm gonna call that one a ball. But there are definitely some issues with consent going on with John Smith. He does not do a good job of taking no for an answer when he is dealing with Pocahontas. It's very uncomfortable.
Even without the historical implications, which it's still very gross. And even if you forget that John Smith is played by Mel Gibson, it's still just, you don't want this romance to work. I mean, sure, Kokomb doesn't seem great, but he's not actively mansplaining everything to Pocahontas. I mean, we know that I'm a Pocahontas Nakoma shipper, but...
And honestly, that's probably the best relationship in her life, so I can't blame you for shipping that. The romance that we're supposed to care about between John Smith and Pocahontas, for anyone who is paying any sort of attention, is just comes off as toxic. We talked about this while we were watching it, but there's a lot of similarities between John Smith in this film and Gaston in Beauty and the Beast, which came out 4 years prior.
They had enough time to know better and course correct, but instead they sort of knuckled down on what if Gaston was the main romantic lead.
It's really frustrating because, and almost whiplashy, coming out of Beauty and the Beast, where these traits are portrayed very negatively and are specifically reasons why Belle does not view Gaston as a legitimate romantic partner. But then you have those same traits portrayed onto the romantic lead of this film, which was specifically trying to emulate the romance subplot of Beauty and the Beast so Disney could get another chance at possibly an Oscar for one of their films. Going back to a slightly lighter and more pedantic topic, this movie has lots of geography issues. I literally ranted for about 2 minutes about why a shot of the river could not possibly work, and if that river were to exist, it would definitely be flowing in the opposite direction than it was in the movie.
And honestly, not understanding nature in a movie where nature is a metaphor for moral rightness is pretty on tone for this movie. So, we're talking about geography. At the end of the film, John Smith gets shot by Ratcliffe, and they're like, oh, we must take him back to London, where the doctors live. And they put him on a boat, which is going to sail across the Atlantic. At this time, that journey could go for anywhere from 3 weeks to 3 months. I'm not sure whose decision it was to think that the best possible hospital for someone was the hold of a boat on a stormy sea for a relatively indeterminate amount of time, with, as far as we can tell, the best doctor being a bag full of aspirin. I know that whether or not John Smith lives or dies is not something I care deeply about, but it's a pedantry thing that you think they might have addressed.
Yeah, I think you can gather our opinions on Pocahontas. It's a beautiful movie. There are some great animations. The montages during the songs visually are stunning. But beyond that, the movie has quite a few structural and tone problems.
Meanwhile, Moana. So, Lindsay Ellis has a really good video on how Moana is in a lot of ways a sort of stealth reboot of Pocahontas. The plots are relatively similar. They're both about indigenous culture. They're both rebellious daughter of chief betters herself and her world narratives. They both involve boats and chauvinist men. But where Pocahontas grounds itself in a reality and is the worst for it, Moana abstracts itself by being in mythic time, and that helps the movie a lot.
The fact that Moana doesn't tie itself to any historical time period, the entire movie deals with myth and legend, so there's quite a bit more leeway. There's also the fact that we don't have Moana dealing with an outsider colonial culture, which again helps ease a lot of the issues that Pocahontas has. Visually, Moana is stunning.
God.
There's this luminosity to the water and all of the effects that go with it that is just gorgeous. Even the scenes where Moana is underwater, everything is clear and discernible. It's not muddy or anything. And it's important that they do that considering how big a narrative part the water and ocean plays in this story. It's a character unto itself.
Mm-hmm. We get these lovely gentle blue greens when Moana's a kid and when she's on her island. We get these deeper blues when they're on the open sea. We get these nasty greenish grays during storms or during the night and when Moana's at her lowest point. We get these really cool purples when they're in the realm of the monsters, etc.
There's also these really great art style shifts when they are dealing with retelling stories. It starts off at the very beginning of the film with Moana's grandma retelling the tale of Maui stealing Tafiti's heart. Jex and I both agreed that we wished the art style had persisted through the entirety of that story, as opposed to cutting at the moment where Maui actually steals the heart and is escaping the island. We also see this art style again with the song You're Welcome by Maui, and the use of it there with Maui's and Moana's 3D models interacting with that art style and that space is really great and interesting. You also see it again throughout the movie with Maui's tattoos, especially when his tattoo self is acting as a sort of Jiminy Cricket figure.
And that gives us some good visual humor, which breaks up some of the reference gags. You also have a lot of good differentiation of the people in the story. You get these wide ranges of face shapes and body shapes in Moana's village, where this movie really does have a great chorus going on. You've got, you know, a few those guys. You've got the old guy who's just like, should we just cook? Hey. We've got the people who are like, we tried fishing there. That doesn't work either. We've got, my roast leaking guy. I don't know their names, but I have a sense of these people as being alive and doing things in the world, that they have lives beyond just the story.
Mm-hmm. They are actual characters and not just plot devices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was kind of worried that Pocahontas might push ahead just for having some really beautiful songs and art styles, but then Moana was here to save us, because all the songs are great in Moana. I'll admit that Shiny takes a little time to get used to, but it kind of grows on me over time.
Shiny is different because it was written by the voice actor who plays Tamatoa. I honestly wish they would have done a little bit more collaboration between Jerome Clemens, who plays Tamatoa, and Lin-Manuel Miranda, who did the rest of the music. I think if there was a little collaboration, Shiny would have stuck out a little bit less and would have been better incorporated. Although because it's kind of the stereotypical villain song of the movie, it's okay that it's a little bit weird and out there.
It's also okay because it takes place in the realm of monsters and is being sung by a mythic figure. I think if Maui's You're Welcome had been just a little bit more different from all the other songs in the movie, it would have been just, oh, these characters have their own musical stylings because they're very different beings, and that's fine. But You're Welcome feels like it fits in with the rest of the movie, whereas Shiny, not quite as much. And again, Shiny is still a fairly good song. It's just that it sticks out as being not quite as fun as the rest. And it's not quite as easy to sing along to, I guess. Whereas, God, everything else you can sing along to so well. You're not even into musicals that much, and you were singing along to You're Welcome.
You're Welcome is really, really great.
We also talked about how Far I'll Go is probably one of the best I Want More songs in recent Disney.
How Far I'll Go is reprised a couple times throughout the film, and each time it's building more into the narrative, and each time it's reprised, Moana is becoming more sure of herself. It's just a song that has a lot of narrative power throughout the film, and it's a really good song.
How well the music all flows together and how much that makes it a very cohesive film works really well. One thing I think is a cohesive and unifying part of the movie that I think does not work as well is the great darkness spreading out from the epicenter of Tafiti / Taka. While I understand the need for some sort of existential danger to get the plot going, I understand the need for there is some sort of problem that must be fixed. I think that having this danger slowly affecting the islands feels very plot device-y, and it could have just been a story about there is a wrong done, that wrong needs to be fixed, without having that wrong being directly affecting the island itself. In the same way, during Moana's lowest point, her grandma says, hey, if this is too much for you, you can go home, that's okay, which is an amazing thing. More mentor figures need to say that. But because of the spreading darkness that's corrupting all the islands, Moana can't go home. She doesn't actually have that option. And when you squint at it too hard, that plot device doesn't quite work.
I don't have the same problems you do with the spreading darkness as a plot device. I actually think it works on the level of, because this trauma was caused to Tafiti, that trauma echoes throughout their community. And I think with the themes that Moana has of community and Moana's arc of learning to become a leader, I think that it works that if Moana wants to be a good leader for her people, she has to be able to right these wrongs that have been done to people before they spread and cause more harm in the community.
But again, the way that this movie works in terms of allegory and being more symbolic and less grounded work to its favor. It feels like a fairy tale, as opposed to these are events that happened exactly as shown.
You touched on it a little bit, but I want to get back into Moana's grandma as a character.
Yes.
So, in general, she's great. The humor she brings to the story and the mentorship she shows Moana is wonderful. Really, all of the mentor figures that Moana has, because she actually has a family, unlike most Disney films, is great. But I do want to talk about Grandma in particular because of what happens right before Moana goes off on her journey. So the film gives you a couple subtle clues about Grandma's deteriorating health. And as you go through this scene with Moana and her grandmother, and the grandmother giving away the secrets that she's been forced to keep about their history and about what Moana needs to do, you see this character give her last bits of vitality to help her granddaughter forward. And it's this self-sacrifice for the betterment of her daughter and the betterment of her community. And it's a very strong point in the narrative.
Agreed. The idea that when grandma dies, she doesn't just go away. She becomes one with the ocean, one with this collective ancestral spiritual force. Works really well in the way that this movie focuses on transformation so much. You have all these characters who don't cease to exist, they become something else, for better or worse. And I think that's a really beautiful thing. I'll admit, I've seen this movie like 4 times this year, and I still cry every time the lights go out and the trees ripple out and Grandma's spirit flows down into the water to help Moana over the waves. I say I've seen this movie 4 times. I think that's partially because it's really good, but figuring out why it's good was weirdly hard because we both felt like there was some trouble with it, and it took us all these watchings to realize that it's because the movie doesn't necessarily have a villain in the traditional sense. The villainess is split between Tamatoa, who's kind of a fairly traditional Disney villain, the Spreading Darkness, which is trouble, and Maui. Moana realizing that Maui was a villain, Maui realizing that Maui was a villain, and instead of having to defeat him, having to get him to be a better person is the main arc. And it's a really interesting thing that Disney has moved from having defeat the villain arcs to redeem the villain arcs. And seeing Maui as the main antagonist for the movie makes a really interesting read, and I think helps Moana as a character because she's able to see the best in everybody, not just Maui, not just Heihei, but also Te Fiti. And her overriding character trait being someone who sees the best in everything and wanting people to be their best selves makes her a really good leader and gives me a lot of confidence for her as a role model for young kids. This generation has a really great role model in Moana, and that's really cool.
And it's not that we're just reading too much into the film and picking out Maui as in this antagonist. The film has a number of subtle ways that it leads you to that conclusion. If you look at the face that Maui has as he's stealing the heart of Taka, it reads as villainous and sinister.
And the really swift shift as it goes from this underlit glowing heart giving him the sinister face to him looking up in a way and that light no longer affects him because he has a light coming from the way he's looking, making him look scared and foolish, is a really, really good metaphor for him as a character and how he has all this power but can oscillate quickly between a villain and a scared child.
Yeah. There's also a number of lines throughout the film spoken by Moana that kind of clue you into this. When first meeting him on the island that he's been marooned on for so long, she mentions that Maui is not her hero. When she's trying to convince Maui to help her return the heart, she starts off by saying, "You're not a hero to anyone anymore. You caused this problem. The only way you can redeem yourself and become a hero is to help me fix it." There's also a point when they are in the realm of monsters and Maui is telling her about Tamatoa and how egotistical he is and he loves talking about herself. Moana comments, "Oh, you two must get along really well."
Tamatoa even mentioned that Maui is his inspiration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Maui and Tamatoa are very clearly supposed to be compared, and it is supposed to affect your perception of Maui as this mythic hero.
Maui's also totally fine leaving this mortal child on an island where he was marooned, and there's very little vegetation or source of life beyond, you know, maybe some birds that pass by, which in any other movie might have been a deeply villainous thing.
There's another interesting thing that this film does is it gives a lot of characters who wouldn't necessarily have motivations for their actions insight into what those motivations are. Again, if you think of Maui as an antagonist, Disney villains have not always had the best characterization when it comes to why they do the evil things that they do. But all of Maui's toxicity and poor choices that he's made previously all come down to him trying to prove himself. His toxicity is caused by his unresolved trauma of being abandoned as a child. We also see this with Moana's father. If you compare Moana's dad with other overbearing fathers from other Disney films, he actually has a motivation for why he is adamant about Moana not going past the reef. He lost his best friend when he tried to do the same, and he is scared for her safety and the safety of anyone that she would take with her. But because it's coming from this place of care and fear for his daughter's safety, it gives a lot more depth to that character and his motivations.
Comparing Maui's character of this brash, bravado-filled person who comes from this root of fear and loss and loneliness to John Smith, whose motivation to go forth and manifest destiny is manifest destiny, it's striking how much we can understand why Maui deserves to be redeemed, whereas John Smith doesn't. the way that Moana's dad and Tafiti and Maui all have these traumas that have to be resolved, and that Moana's resolving of the three of them is all part of the same journey is really cool. And the way that this healing affects the entire community and allows them all to go off and rekindle this love of sailing and exploration that their culture once had is really interesting.
Like, as much as we both have been gushing about Moana, there are some weird problems with it. There's a lot of meta humor going on with Moana that doesn't always work. There's this joke, when you write something with a bird, it's called a tweet. Or when Maui explicitly calls out Moana as being a princess, she attempts to argue. And he's like, if you have an animal sidekick, you are a princess. Some of that stuff lands, but some of it doesn't.
There's a bit where they reach the top of the mountain thingy where before they jump into the Sea of Monsters, and Moana's looking out across the sea, and Maui's in the background, and he's like, if you start singing, I'm gonna throw up. Which, sure, the idea that this sort of chauvinist meta character is opposed to singing in a Disney movie, haha, a good joke. But up to this point, Moana has not sung in front of Maui, but Maui has sung in front of her, so the line doesn't fit with the experiences these characters have explicitly had, and it feels like it was left in from another draft, and someone was like, ah, yes, this is brilliant, and it isn't.
One other nitpicky thing, I don't really think Pua the pig does a whole lot for the story. The bait and switch of, well, obviously the pig is going to be her animal companion, and then replacing it with Hey Hey the chicken, I don't know, it feels weird. I don't mind Hey Hey in that role as animal companion. It kind of leads into Moana's leadership ability to see value and worth in everyone. And Hey Hey does have that redeeming moment towards the climax of the film. If it weren't for him, the heart may have been lost. So his, like, Hey Hey actually has this really great arc of, no, Moana is going to keep him around and encourage him. And he eventually becomes heroic in that one scene.
And Hey Hey's uselessness leads to some great comedy, especially when everybody around him is just like, maybe we should just eat him. The ocean, who keeps having to save Hey Hey, the bit where, towards the end, the ocean opens a basket, dunks Hey Hey in the basket, puts the lid back on the basket, shoves the basket into the hold and slams the hold shut, like, no, stay here. That makes me laugh, so I'm okay with it. I think the Hey Hey pig thing has some metaphorical worth, as you expect this great thing, but what you get is not so great, and you have to make it work. That fits with Moana's arc. I think I do want to say that gives merit to both of these movies is that they both have a lot of the voice actors come from the cultures that are being displayed, and I appreciate that.
Yeah, that is one thing I will give Disney credit for, is especially with Moana, they recruited a complete newcomer to voice and do the singing voice of Moana. She does an amazing job. Well, I think it's that time for us to
Moana
render our final decision. But yes, obviously Moana.
Yeah.
Again, these narratives are incredibly similar, and Moana just has a lot less structural and tone problems than Pocahontas does. This was a relatively easy week, and I'm sure many of you saw this coming a mile away. But that's not to say that Pocahontas is an awful movie or irredeemable. It just has some problems.
I'm not sure if... So I know we just, you know, spent 20 minutes gushing about a movie about redeeming villains, but I'm not sure if Pocahontas is redeemable. I'm not sure if you can make that story work as a Disney movie. At least not without cutting out vast swathes of the movie.
I doubt that Disney is going to attempt to retell that story anytime soon. There are a lot of other films in their library that they can redo as live-action films or whatnot. So we've probably seen the last of Pocahontas for quite some time, and I'm okay with that. Next week, when we return, we'll be talking about Cinderella.
Yay!
Against Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Yay! But in Gregorian chant.
Which will be a little bit more traditional as far as typical Disney fare goes. So we hope to see you tune in next week, and keep an eye on our Facebook and Twitter pages. Until then, this has been the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast.